gonna let him treat Poochie like dirt anymore just because he's the new guy.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. Third time's a charm as I've absolutely butchered the intro twice already, so we're going to see how we go on this one. Great to have you all in for the podcast. I'm Rob Calder, joined by Nick Mihai. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Good to be back.
Excellent to have you in here. And the new guy, Dave Peters. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
It's a man of many words early, obviously. The new high-performance coach for the Vic Metro Men, newly appointed. So congratulations on the new role.
Appreciate it.
Give us a little bit of the Dave Peters background in more than two words, if you can.
The background. So played a lot of my basketball at Melbourne. Moved into the Big V. Played about 5 years in the Big V after doing my college basketball out in Lassen College in California. So from there, didn't do much in the senior space and moved into coaching straight from my playing career. Did some coaching with the Melbourne Tigers in the junior space, and then was lucky enough to have Nick Abdusevich out there. He was working with state teams at the time, so managed to just be around some of the state teams that he was a part of and jumped onto their staff and worked my way up that pathway. So, yeah, just was at Melbourne for about 10 years, joined a few state teams in the under-16s and 18s and worked my way up into Casey as a BDM there for the last 4 years. Did some NBL1 coaching at that time. And then it was time for me to make my way to Basketball Victoria. So joined Basketball Victoria as a state development coach about 11 months ago.
It's gone quick.
It's gone quick, yep. And then, as we all know, a couple of opportunities opened up with Darren and Coops jumping out of their positions. So applied and was successful to, become the next HP coach for Metro.
Awesome. Well, it's going to be fantastic. We do have to stop, employing people that listen to the podcast because their numbers go down, as it turns out. But fantastic to have you in here. What is your, I suppose, vision for the role over the next, 12 to 24 months?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Obviously, like Metro Men have had a lot of success over the course of the last 6, 7, 8 years. So you could jump into this role and think, oh, there's not a lot to change, but that's never the case. There's always something new. There's always something fresh that anyone that comes into the role can bring. So I think for me, I just want to take it back to where it was and really hone in on the fundamental skills for the athletes, really work on individual skill development. We'll have a system of play. We might focus a little less on that and more on the individual athlete and really work on some of those weaknesses to provide them with what we would call an elite skill. Yep. I know a lot of us speak about, every athlete hopefully has one or two elite skills that we can then select them on for a state team or an Australian team. So that's something we want to put more focus into.
Yep.
That's sort of the pathway we're going to take. Cool.
Did you cross paths with Nick as a player? Like, was your playing career at the same time as Nick's playing career?
Yep, we did a little bit, I think, in under-16s and under-18s.
16s, 18s for grading.
Yep.
And then you got the bump. Oh,
you got bumped.
No, up.
Up. Yeah, gotcha.
As in bump.
I thought you got cut.
No.
You were saying. Yeah, gotcha.
He certainly didn't. We won't go into that part. But afterwards. And then youth league as well, obviously, with what I believe was the best team ever.
Yeah, Nick was a very good screener for me, a good rebounder, and he helped me a lot on the defensive end. So I owe a lot of my basketball career to Nick.
Helped you a lot on the defensive end. Is that making up for shortcomings, or was that because he was an elite communicator on the backside of that?
No, making up for shortcomings on my behalf, yeah.
Good role play, Nick.
Is it fair bit? I'm a really good talker as well, as you know, on the pod, so that translated into basketball too, so that really helped.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, fantastic to have you on for your first pod, DP. So we'll get into a couple of things that we have to cover off. Obviously, the reminder, you can follow on X, Instagram and YouTube on the @TalkingSplit handle for any of the podcast stuff, any of the information that we have going out, drills, those sorts of things. Reminder, Coach Wellbeing Month coming up. We'll be dropping all the information in October and setting some daily and weekly challenges and tasks for coaches to do in November. So as we try and move the needle in the right direction in terms of coach health and wellbeing. If there's anything you want to talk about, please let us know and we'll get researching on that. As every week, the Run to Unplug. So on Friday the 24th of October, Luke Lehman is taking a 24-hour run around the Mentone Athletics track from midnight Thursday the 23rd until midnight Friday the 24th to raise awareness and support for Smack Talk and Unplug 24. You can be a part of that by coming down to running a lap, run 10 laps, run 100 laps. You can register for 24 hours of social media unplugging, which is smacktalk.com.au/unplug24/. And you can follow along on Instagram, run2unplug. You can follow along with that. You've committed to 10 laps, haven't you?
Yeah, I was just about to say it. How's that spread so quick? Yeah, I've committed to 10 laps because I wanted Luke to join my walking group. And he said I would only join the walking group if you do give me 10 laps. So you might see Orlando and myself out there.
For 10 laps?
Yep. I'm going to do it. It's on the pod. It's there. Only if he joins the... If he doesn't do the walking group, I'm out. Like, I'm just letting you know.
I'm not confident of this happening, to be honest.
Oh. If he joins the walking group, I'm telling you now, I'll do 10 laps. I don't know how long it's going to take me, but like, I'll do 10 laps.
Exactly right. You know you have to run it with him, don't you? And he would have probably been running. Like, this
No, it's not a race. I can do it at my own pace.
With him. That's the idea.
I can do it at my own pace. Yeah, but he'll catch up to me on the way through. There's no way I'm keeping up with him. No, I'll let you know that now.
Well, it depends on when you run it. If you're running in an hour one, probably not. If you're an hour 24, I reckon you're a fair chance. Yeah, like, time you run is the big important part with this. So we are on to Soundbites Part 2 after last week's episode. There was a whole bunch of them we didn't manage to get through, so we're in on this one. As always, if you've got any thoughts or opinions of those, by all means, shoot them into the comments or on email and we can go over it in a little bit more detail. First one for this week is Matt Painter on shot selection.
Coaches fight is shot selection. Mm-hmm. Every coach. I don't care if you're playing international basketball, in the NBA, in college, in high school, shot selection. Like, because the one thing about taking good shots and missing them, you're normally going to set your defense still. Mm-hmm. Now, you make shots, you're going to set your defense because they got to take it out. But the more you can get your offense to get your defense to set up, and now they're looking at 10 eyes, you just made yourself a better defensive team right there. But if you're going to turn it over and take bad shots and play in transition D all the time, oh, man, you're in trouble.
It's going to be tough.
You're in deep trouble. So that's something for us that I really get on right away, but I talk through it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't get absolute with them until they have numbers and they have data. Hey, man, this is what you've done for 3 years. This is what you've done for 2 years.
So shot selection and defensive transition, obviously very closely related in that space. Where do you sit with defensive transition, Dave? Like, do you have rules in terms of who you want going where? Is it just a case of quality shots will equal better defensive transition? Like, where do you sit with the whole thing?
Yeah, it's something we've simplified a little bit over the course of the last couple of years. We've been focusing a little bit more, at least the teams that I've coached anyway, we've focused a little bit more on just having like the 3, 4, and 5 go to the boards and the 1 and 2s back to the pillars or the slots, as a lot of people know it as. We find that just creates less confusion. Everyone has a role. It's really easy to understand who's completing their role and who's not. In terms of shot selection that feeds into that, that's obviously an important one. Again, the two teams that I've coached most recently has been a senior team and then an under-20s level team. In terms of shot selection that we've asked from them, we've headed more towards, I guess, the data-driven shots, which are open threes, shots at the rim and free throws. Like, that's what we're hunting as much as possible. And what we found with that, at least lately, is the more we get those types of, I guess, gold-level shots that we require, it feeds into really clear defensive transition because everyone gets to their roles really quick and everyone knows when the shot is going up, ideally. Yeah. So that's helped our offense as well.
Yep. Is that something you noticed? Because you've just come back from a US trip recently where you were coaching over there. Is that something that was obvious playing at that level as well?
Yep. Yeah, definitely. Both within the team that I coached, we were able to pick up, I guess, those concepts really quickly, and we saw that really help us across the 2 weeks we were there. Playing against some elite athletes, like, our defensive transition was something that was really positive across those 2 weeks. And I think a lot of that had to do with the types of shots we were taking and then what our rules were on D-trans. In terms of the opposition we played against, we also saw similar types of setups. In terms of 3 to the glass, 2 to the pillars, and the Americans were just so drilled at being able to rebound, and if they didn't have a dunk to go straight back up, they'd throw it back out to a shooter, and they were straight back into their offense, whether it be shooting the next three or playing off of that. So Yeah.
Were they similar to us in terms of, you know, we play with a bit of pace, we're looking to hunt shots early. Let's say for the USA teams, are they looking to shoot the three early? Because that would impact our D-trans. So he speaks a little bit about predictable shots. It's kind of hard to get to if we're playing with that pace as well.
Yeah, so what I actually noticed with them was they were really aggressive in hunting threes in transition, especially off turnovers. Yep. So very different to us in terms of how we want to play with advantages and play with two-on-ones and three-on-twos and attack the basket and maybe get to the free throw line if you don't get a finish. They were really well drilled at running to the wing, kick ahead passes, no dribbles in transition, and taking early three-point shots. And they were elite at it. Like, it was hard to sort of, you know, go against what they were doing.
Was that because they were great shooters or they were great offensive rebounders or a bit of a combination of both?
It was a bit of a combination.
Yeah.
In transition was like they were so quick to get to spots and the guards were so drilled at just making great kickhead passes.
Yep.
And the shooters were knocking those down. On the offensive end in terms of rebounding, they were just very good at – we talk about it a lot in coaching in terms of what's next. And yep. They were just very good at having drilled into them what's next. And the rebounders knew if they couldn't go back up, it was straight to a shooter at the slot. They almost didn't need to even look. The shooter was already there.
Those early threes, it would probably make it predictable in itself, right? Like they're sprinting, hunting, and they go, if it's going to that guy, it's going up, you know, straight away.
Was it mainly like corner threes, 45 threes? Is that where they tended to get most of it?
Mainly 45 threes.
Yeah, okay.
And it made us really understand that, geez, if you turn the ball over, it's not a two-point swing. It's a three-point swing here. And it was quick. It was within, you know, 3 to 4 seconds. Yep. So we had to really take care of the ball after that.
Yeah, interesting. What about you, Nick? Defensive transition, is that you are coaching a youth league team again this year? Best behaviour. Yep. Like, don't be chewing out refs or anything like that.
I'm good, I promise. I promise.
You say that in preseason.
What was the last one? 10 ways to lose a game, don't worry. Yep. I've listened to it four or five times. I'm good.
Yeah, gotcha. How early is the discussion about defensive transition and shot selection coming into a new team? Because you are coming in like as a new coach with new players and those sorts of things. How early is that discussion for you?
It's coming in straight away. And the reason is, for me personally, when we have a team, if it's not a universal program at the club, it's changing depending on what players I have.
Yep.
Okay, so in some instances, you send two to the glass and three back. Some instances, you send four to the glass and one back, and sometimes you can even tag up if you want to as well. I don't generally tag up either, but that conversation's happening straight away as soon as I've assembled the personnel. This is the personnel that I've got or what I think we have. How are we going to manage the D-trans after that? From there, with the young youth league team, who are the shooters? Where do they like to shoot from? There's plenty of video out there these days. This is more older age groups as well, of course, but there's plenty of video out there as well. So I'm trying to figure out the most comfortable positions that these players can be in and then start repping predictable shots after that straight away as soon as we select the team.
It is interesting. Like, the defensive transition stuff is such a byproduct of your shot selection, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, if you're going to get anything right, get shot selection right, and that will fix probably 80% of your defensive transition problems, because it's not hard to get back on D. It's just hard if you don't know when you have to get back on D, and that's kind of the one I find the most. And it's interesting you say you've gone to the two pillars, in particular on defensive transition, because I think I was probably much of the more traditional 3-1-1, like 3-to-glass, 1-to-ball pickup and 1-to-safety. I don't know that we're in a position now where we can only send 1-to-safety anymore. Like, I think we have to send 2 back because the numbers are just coming back at us the other way so quickly now that we need 2 back on D. And depending on who you're playing, like, obviously if you are playing some of those American teams, it's like, get 5 guys back. Like, and it may still not matter. Like, it may.
That's what I was going to ask you as well. Would you send 5 back in juniors and just completely take away the opportunity for the offensive rebound? Because percentages do change as well when you rebound, kick out. The percentage of the shot is higher because you're throwing out to a shooter. You're giving that up.
Yeah. Offensive rebounding is a skill, though. Mm. Like, and I'd hate to think we're taking it away from something that people can just instinctively hunt boards and get after it as well. Like, if you're the random 5 that's in your team, do you want to be told, don't worry about rebounding, just get back? Like, that's... you're probably not helping them. Like, I think you'll be more successful on the scoreboard, but I don't think you're helping your player. That's probably my stance on it. Are you any different, Dave?
No, I think like if you have an excellent rebounder like that, you can have the specific rules that you were talking about, where when this 5's on the floor, that player's allowed to go get it.
Yep.
When this 5's on the floor, we're sending 3 or 4 back. I think it's personnel driven as well. When I talk about the pillars that we use, that's something that I'm probably implementing across a program as a whole. And it was something that I enjoyed doing on the tour that I just went to. So I saw some success there. But, yeah, for a team that's training for a season where you're just working with potentially 10 or 12 athletes, you might be able to be a bit more specific about it.
And that's where probably tagging up comes into it as well. Like, that's another one that I think you'd have to implement over the course of a season. I don't think you can get that done quickly.
I think that takes longer than a season.
Oh, without a doubt.
Because it's very difficult.
Yeah. If that's a program rule, I think it works.
Yeah.
Like, if you have that from 12s through 18s and into your seniors, yeah, okay, sure, they've had enough time to get used to it. As a one-off season, I think if you're trying to teach your team tagging up and it's not across your program, it might be a little bit futile, just in terms of getting it embedded. And I mean, there aren't too many senior players that love tagging up in the first place. So you might have your own challenges there as you get older, but it is something to just be a little bit mindful of too, I think. Next one is Cara Mori on grit.
Of course, talent matters. Like, I could get in a pool and train with Michael Phelps and never come close to beating him in a race. But if you read the book Grit, Duckworth argues that effort is worth twice as much as talent. So if we're going to hold on to this bias and we're going to continue to recruit the most talented kids on the ice, we better learn how to develop their grit. Because grit is what turns potential into reality.
So we think of that from a junior perspective in particular. So we talk about who the most talented kids are all the time. Obviously, you have to pick them for programs and all those sorts of things. We get that. How much of a determining factor is their grit and their resilience when selecting an athlete, Nick? Like, is that something that you identify? Is that something you can work on? Is there scope for where you see it improving? Like, what's it look like?
For me, it's just a simple one to see how they deal with adversity. You know, miss a shot, turnover, how do they react? That's a great way to determine what their resilience looks like. I think Zoe said this a while ago, where there's three things that you need for a junior athlete. I'm going to butcher this, by the way, so I wish I told you beforehand. But it was, you've either got to have the skill, the size, or the drive. And the one thing you can't compromise on is the drive. You know, so you can, it compensates for those other two things, but you can't not have the drive. And I think that's just so important. Ways to find it, seeing like just simple hustle plays. You know, if they're in a trial and they're bringing their team in and they're really fired up just to do a scrimmage, like, you can see that they want it and they want to be on the floor. But just how they react to adversity and when things don't go right, that's the greatest judgment of character for me. And that's something that I really look for in trials as well. Not when you're making every single shot, but when something doesn't go right, how do you respond to it?
Yep. What about you, Dave? Is it something that you can identify easily, or is it something you can be taught? Is it just inbuilt? Like, where do you sit with it?
I think it's ingrained in a lot of athletes' personalities.
Yep.
I think people can get better at it. I think in terms of identifying it, it's not something you can just pick off one or two plays. I think it's something you need to watch a game or a few training sessions and really get an idea of what that athlete's habits are in terms of how they react to adversity, what their resilience is, how they go with a bad call from the referee, how they go with being subbed off by their coach, how they go with being open from three and not receiving the ball. I think those are the things that happen very often, and you could really tell straight away from body language how that athlete's reacted and how that's going to affect their team. So, like, we're talking about grit. Grit sort of determines a bit, or comes from what your character's like, and I think your character's based on what your habits are like. So that's the way I kind of tie all that in together, whether that's right or not. And, like, if kids or our athletes have good habits and we see into how they respond to certain events, whether they're positive or negative, that really tells us, like, are they going to be a good teammate, and is that someone we want in our program or on our teams? Because it's not just about talent. I think we all know that. We can all agree on that. That's not something that we speak about that's new. But we want the right personalities on the team that are going to, you know, give us good chemistry at the end of the day.
Yeah, and personality plays such a big part of it, because I think we could all probably sit there and watch, like, Dellavedova diving on loose balls and all those sorts of things in that NBA final series, and everyone's like, oh, it's a gritty play. Those things are easy to see because they're right in front of our eyes. The hard ones are the chat off to the side with a player that might be struggling with something. That player goes and says, well, look, I'm going to try and talk to them about this. Those are the gritty sort of things that it's like, look, when things aren't going well, as you said before, Nick, what does it look like? Where do they fit, I suppose, within that? And that is a time process. I don't think you can fix that in a trial, or I don't think you can see it in a trial. There are some things that will obviously stick out, but I think it's more of a case of you'll see that over the course of a season. And you know, how gritty are kids in under 12s? They're probably not. Like, because at that stage, they're still just having fun. Then there isn't that almost chip on the shoulder mentality of, you know, I'm going to find a way in under 12s. Probably only comes out in about under 16s, I find. That's when you probably first see it.
It's because they kind of get their identity and their personality comes out a little bit as well. Yep. I agree with you. Now that I think about it, like over a year, you would find it because they kind of let their guard down and you see their real self. So it does come down to personality big time. It always just reverts back to that, doesn't it?
Well, and how often do coaches talk about toughness?
Yeah.
And, you know, we want to be the toughest team, we want to be the grittiest team. It's like, well, okay, as a coach, what are you doing to find that? And part of that is player empowerment and handing over some of the control to the players. So, like, hey, you design this session. And if the session is like, oh, we're just going to shoot the ball for 60 minutes, it's like, oh, maybe I don't have the gritty team that I thought I did. But if it's going to be like, hey, we're going to go into 2-on-2, into 3-on-3, into 4-on-4, into shell, and then into up back. And it's like, maybe we do have a gritty team here. Like,
I would really struggle to let players design my training session. It would be very hard for me to undo what I've done for all these years. Do you know what I mean? Like, they would definitely be a part of it. Hey, we're thinking about this. What are your thoughts? But letting them create one on their own would be really difficult for me.
To be honest, have a crack at it. Yep. Because Zoe tried it last week with her last MPP session of the year. Okay. She said, look, who's coming, who's not coming? Give me something you want to do in this session. That's designed a pretty good session. Like, and a lot of it was stuff that they have done previously. So there's probably an element of, hey, I remember that drill. I didn't mind that drill. Let's put that in type stuff. But actually came up with a pretty good session, and the amount of buy-in they got in that session, like, at no point did we have to motivate or remind or anything like that. It was like, no,
so
we're
doing
stuff
later on, though. You think later on, like, not, you're not a couple of weeks in. Not a couple of weeks in. We're talking end of the season. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even just mid-season is a little bit of a freshen up. I think it's a good time to do it as well. I don't know that I do it every week.
I'll let you know how I go in June.
it's something I actually touched on in under 18s, just for one session. We were kind of going through a pretty successful season and we just needed something that was different. Yep. And what was great was just seeing different players lead different segments of the session and just seeing how different they were in that role versus being in a pick and roll situation on the floor.
Makes sense.
Seeing them lead an activity, you know, saw different leadership skills, saw much better communication skills because some people were just better in that environment.
Just a one-off, Dave? Yeah. Or was it like, hey, this is pretty good, let's just keep doing this? Like, I don't...
Feet up as the coach and just like, hey, they got this.
Hey, I like the idea. I just...
It was definitely just a one-off.
Yeah.
There's only so much control you can give up in that coaching space.
All right, that'll do. Good job,
you know,
boys.
Your time. And it's always dependent on how the game goes after that. Like, if you walk out and you are just awful, it's like, never doing that again. But if they have a good one, it's like, hey, maybe we could lean into this a little bit more. It does depend a lot on your group. The next ones are from Scott Scheffler on satisfaction, effectively, for lack of a better term. This one does go for around about 5 minutes, so the two of you can put your feet up on this one, and just same with the coaches listening. There's a bit to get through here.
You know, I think it's kind of funny. I think, you know, I think I said something after the Byron this year about, like, it feels like you work your whole life to celebrate winning a tournament for, like, a few minutes. It only lasts a few minutes, that kind of euphoric feeling. And I, like, to win the Byron Nelson Championship at home, I literally worked my entire life to become good at golf, to have an opportunity to win that tournament. And you win it, you celebrate, get to hug my family, my sister's there. It's such an amazing moment. And then it's like, okay, now what are we gonna eat for dinner? You know, life goes on. Is it great to be able to win tournaments and to accomplish the things I have in the game of golf? Yeah, I mean, it brings tears to my eyes just to think about, because it's literally worked my entire life to become good at this sport, and to have that kind of sense of accomplishment, I think is a pretty cool feeling. You know, to get to live out your dreams is very special. But at the end of the day, it's like, I'm not out here to inspire the next generation of golfers. I'm not here to inspire somebody else to be the best player in the world, because what's the point? You know, this is not a fulfilling life. It's fulfilling from the sense of accomplishment, but it's not fulfilling from a sense of, like, the deepest, you know, places of your heart. You know, there's a lot of people that make it to what they thought was going to fulfill them in life, and then you get there and all of a sudden you get to number one in the world, and then they're like, what's the point? And, you know, I really do believe that, because, you know, what is the point? You're like, why do I want to win this tournament so bad? That's something that I wrestle with on a daily basis. It's like showing up at the Masters every year. It's like, why do I want to win this golf tournament so badly? Why do I want to win the Open Championship so badly? I don't know. Because if I win, it's going to be awesome for about 2 minutes. And then we're going to get to the next week, and it's going to be like, hey, you won two majors this year. How important is it for you to win the FedEx Cup playoffs? And it's just like, we're back here again, you know? So we really do. We work so hard for such little moments. And, you know, I'm kind of a sicko. I love putting in the work. I love being able to practice. I love getting out to live out my dreams. But at the end of the day, sometimes I just don't understand the point, you know, because I don't know if I'm making any sense or not, but am I not? It's just one of those deals, you know. I love the challenge. I love being able to play this game for a living. It's one of the greatest joys of my life. But does it fill the deepest, you know, wants and desires of my heart? Absolutely not. I mean, I love playing golf. I love being able to compete. I love living out my dreams. I love being a father. I love being able to take care of my son. I love being able to provide for my family out here playing golf. And you know, every day when I wake up early to go put in the work, you know, my wife thanks me for going out and working so hard. And when I get home, I try and thank her every day for taking care of our son. It's just, you know, that's why I talk about families being my priority, because it really is. You know, I'm blessed to be able to come out here and play golf, but if my golf ever started affecting my home life, or it ever affected the relationship I have with my wife or with my son, you know, that's going to be the last day that I play out here for a living. You know, this is not the be all end all. This is not the most important thing in my life. And that's why I wrestle with, why is this so important to me? Because, you know, I would much rather be a great father than I would be a great golfer. You know, that at the end of the day, that's what's more important to me.
We'll end it there, just a little bit before the 5 minute cut off, more than anything else. Interesting perspective on someone that is a world number one, obviously mastered an individual sport for sure. So golf is obviously very unique in that sort of world. But interesting to hear, like, the what motivates, where is the satisfaction, those types of stances. Where does that apply, I suppose, Dave, to your coaching? And when you sort of hear someone like that has been at that level, talk about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know for me as a coach, the drive comes from me being a competitor. Yep. And I love the competitive side of things. Winning is a bonus. Like, yep. I want to win. Everyone in this room wants to win. But I think we all agree, like, the good feeling you get from winning is not the same as the bad feeling you get from losing.
Oh, for sure.
And
are you a I hate losing more than I like winning person?
For sure.
Yep, yep. Same. Nick?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
you know, the win feels good for about, I don't know, 24 hours, and then you kind of on to the next thing, and you kind of forget about it, whereas that bad feeling of losing can last a week sometimes, if not longer.
Yep.
So
I'm still scarred. Like, there's some stuff I've not got over yet I probably should have dealt with internally. But
are we going to air some stuff now? Because I've got some things. If you
I think, like, for me, where I go with it and the feeling I get from being involved in sport, and, you know, I've been lucky enough to be involved in some high-level teams and be part of some high-level programs. It's the people that I've worked with, like you and Nick, I've known for such a long time through basketball, and yep. That's the only reason we're all friends. Or maybe there's other reasons now.
No, you got it. You got it.
But
yeah, Rob told me this on day one. Don't yeah.
But for the most part, like, that started off a journey of, you know, for us, over Nick and I, over 25 years of friendship or something like that, and almost just as long with Rob. And yep. And I know that's how I feel about players that I actually played with when I was a junior. Yep. And I'm pretty sure I tried to instill some of those things with the teams I've coached. And to this day, I'm still in touch with some players that I coached in under 16s from the first time that I ever stepped onto a court as a coach in 2011. Yep. And I know they're close with their teammates still to this day. So I understand where he's coming from. Winning is not the be-all and end-all. Yep. Championships and trophies is not the be-all and end-all. It's, you know, the journey that you are on is one that I feel like creates so many memories, and that's why I do it. And I think that's why a lot of us in this room have been a part of this sport for such a long time.
Yep.
Everyone has their own perspective on it.
No, really like it. What about you, Nick?
I'm about to butcher a quote.
Okay. Finally, we had a grab for that.
Winning. It's so funny. I say a different thing every week and he doesn't have a grab for it. So I'm just trying to stay one step ahead. Anyway, winning pours champagne into the glass and then immediately knocks it off the table.
Okay.
So basically you win and then the next day it's like, okay, what's next? So I think the competitive side, I think it's about progression. Like you're progressing, you're achieving something more, you're getting closer to your task. It's not actually reaching the top of the mountain. It's the climb that you that appeals to you the most. At the start of this as well, we mentioned that Dave and myself were on the same youth league team and I said best team ever. We didn't win it that year. We were in Youth League 2 because that's where we entered into as well. So it wasn't Youth League 1. But I always go back. And if you ask anyone on that team, I reckon they have the same answer. And it's got way more to do than winning. I don't even know how many we won, Dave. We won a few, but I don't know exactly where we finished on the ladder, anything like that. It was the memories of that year that appeals to me the most. You know what I mean?
It is interesting because I think back on a lot of stuff. And look, basketball is absolutely the vehicle. Like there's no question about it. Like it's, you know, is it the defining moment in your life? Look, maybe for some people, but ultimately basketball will be around, you know, in whatever capacity you want it to be for the rest of your life. But I also think back to, I was the head coach of 3 state teams, 2 silvers and a gold. I was searching for a friend after the silvers. I had nothing but friends after the gold. And it's like, that's a really dire look at it in a lot of ways. It's like, well, who is there when the chips are down? Who is there to offer support? Who is there to offer encouragement when you actually need it? And it's easy to high-five people. Like, that's the real easy one to get done. And everyone would probably be the same. You achieve something, your phone blows up with really well done. If something goes wrong, how often do you get the, hey, feeling for you, or that sucks, or whatever it is like that you need? And that's, like, when you think fulfillment, it's the messages you get after a loss that I think are more fulfilling than the ones you get after a win. Like, so for mine, like, I hear exactly what you're both saying. In both of that, like it's the fulfillment doesn't necessarily come from basketball. I think basketball is just the vehicle that we use to get to that fulfillment point. I think anyway, that's my take on it. The next one is Buzz Williams on leadership.
I think it's hard in this day and age in any position of leadership to not give ownership away. I think a lot of the ways that coaches went about leading when I was young, I think 0% of that translates to today. I think you have to spend an inordinate amount of time building relationships with your guys off the floor. Yes, you need to work with them on the floor. Yes, they need to feel as though what you're doing allows their game to improve. But if you don't love them and they don't trust you, they believe that you are selfish, that you're arrogant, they are, quote, working for you. I don't think any of that works.
Interesting one. It's a little bit of a look behind the curtain here. We had state team interviews recently, only a couple of weeks ago. One of the questions that was in there, what are you the best at? Like, what makes you the best at what you do? And nearly every coach to a letter said relationships. And nearly every one of them. And they can't all be the best at relationships. That's not how that works. So if that is such a big part of what makes coaches great coaches, and you hear that, like coaching, like we say it all the time, like it's, you cannot talk to a coach over the age of probably about 35 at the moment that doesn't sit there and pine for yesteryear with, oh, kids were just different, you know, 10, 15 years ago than what they are now. Like, yeah, no kidding. Like, so with the coaching, like it was very different 10, 15 years ago. I think back at my junior coaches, I don't think I had a real connection with too many of them. It was do what you're told because we're telling you to do it and this is what we have to do. Whereas now it changes a lot. Like, how do you go about building relationships and then leaders within your group, Nick, given you have got a new group coming?
Yeah, it comes down to your IPP, so individual performance pathway, and what you've got written in there. So when you sit down with them, with the older groups at the start of the year, this is what I see on the film. What are you good at? And then we try and find that middle ground in between it. There's other questions in there as well, but that's where our starting point is, to build that rapport. Hey, I want to hear from you. I want to hear what you think you're good at. This is what I'm seeing. Let's see if we can meet in the middle here. And I think that's the starting point that I would start with building a rapport, like trusting them enough to give me feedback on themselves, I think is a great start. We are moving into a new era of leadership in coaching, aren't we? Like we talk about all the time how we used to be coached to now. It's completely different. But how we coach now is far more powerful. The building the relationships, the rapport. But what's really important is if you're going to do that, you can't fake it. Don't pretend to build relationships with players. It doesn't work. They see right through you, and it can actually have an even worse effect than it started. So just be careful with your, like, if you're going to build rapport or relationship, it has to be real. It has to be genuine as well. Yep.
Does that, like, you think about this, like you said you played college basketball for a little bit, Dave. How different was being coached at that era, without aging you too much, compared to what it looks like now?
Yeah, very different. Even just from when I played juniors to college to now, like, when I coached juniors, how much I've changed as a coach and how much we involve the athletes these days in decisions that we're making in terms of training or games or what our game plan is. We very much have a plan, and then we want to make the athletes a part of that journey and a part of that plan, and we want them to feel like they've been listened to. And that's something that's really changed a lot, and something that I've gotten better as a coach across these years. If I just talk about my time coming back into the BV space, HB space, because I had some time away while I was focusing on senior basketball, like, it took me a good 3, 4, 5, 6 months to really build some trust with our current HP athletes that we've got. And like Nick said, you can't fake it. It can't happen in a day or a week. It took time, you know. I genuinely asked about what they did on the weekend. I wanted to know how their club team went. I wanted to know how their school tournaments went. I wanted to find out about them. And then slowly you get the same back from them. And then you build a rapport. And then it's much easier for me to provide them with feedback, whether they like it or not on the court.
Yeah, yeah,
different problem. Because we've got that relationship. And, it's definitely not anything like how it was when we were players, Nick. We were told to run from A to B, and we did that.
Yep.
Now it's very different. I feel like there's a why in there that we have to continue to explain. This is why we're doing this. And I think that really helps today's athlete want to learn and then want to play hard for you.
Yeah, your last point in there of we've got to explain the why, I think is so important though now. It's not just a case of, hey, we're doing this drill to do this drill, which I feel like it might have been when I was playing, but to be fair, I didn't play at a good level, so it was probably just a coach trying to keep their head above water, to be completely honest. But now it really is, why are we doing this? Where is this applying? Like, and you have to explain it. That's the biggest killer, is that you have to be aware of what's going on in that space, because people will look to you as the leader, which is fine. Like, that's your job as a coach. There's no issue with that. But it is that rapport building side of things and relationships. Like I said, all the coaches in state team interviews went down that path. There was only maybe one or two that didn't. And to be fair, those answers were actually very good, the ones that weren't. Like, they did a really good job of articulating what they were the best at.
Did they go into I know you can't say too much. Did they go into detail about what they meant by that? No. Are you allowed to get...
No, okay. Probably not enough, in all honesty.
Okay, so it was very service level. I build relationships next. Okay.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And that's the biggest thing, is like, well, okay, show me how that would apply. Where would this be useful? What would you use it for? That's the sort of level we were trying to get to. And like, that surface level, everyone can care on the surface. Like, that's the easy one. But it's can you care when chips are down and when it matters, and when we talk resilience and those sorts of things, you know, do you still care? Or is it now just, you know, like I said, Dave, it took you 6 months to get buy-in.
Yep.
You can lose that in about 60 seconds.
Yep.
Like, if you just treat something the wrong way, all of that 6 months of work goes. And that's the hardest part, I think, for coaches, is to remember that this is a long-term investment. This is not a short-term thing.
Do you think it's because, as a coaching cohort, we understand the relationship part is important, but we don't quite understand yet how to, like, articulate it and detail it and put a program together to build that? Like, we're trying to use our coach mind to do something that's a social skill.
Yeah, interesting, Tate. And I don't know is the answer. Like, it was interesting when Mike Dunlap was out here, I can't remember if it was this year or last year, he said the best coaching development he ever got was just being a parent. He's like, all of a sudden I started to understand why I have to do things a certain way, how I would do things a certain way. He's like, even before he had kids, he went to a parenting class because he thought that would make him a better coach. And it's like, yeah, makes sense. Like, now you learn to articulate things better. You understand the psychology behind things. I think there's something to it. Like, it's, yeah, I don't know. How are you going being a dad?
Well, he's not quite talking yet, so I'm pretty good at the moment. It's all good.
His first word comes in Romanian. You've got some answering to do. But, you know, that's part of it. I think it's, and you know, I'm in a position where I don't have kids. So I'm trying to work that out kid by kid, little by little as we go through that as well. So I think there's an element of, look, society is changing, of course. Kids are changing. Parents are changing. All of it sort of loops in together, and I don't think we're going to really understand what this generation looks like for probably another 15 years. When we can look back on it and compare it to something else, because at the moment we're just kind of pedaling hard to try and keep up with them at the moment.
I think we're in a difficult spot as coaches at times, because the coach in me wants to come in with a plan and I want this plan to be successful, and I think this is the best way to do it sometimes. But you have to understand there's 10 individuals on the court that have had 10 different days than you have. A good day at school, a bad day at school, a relationship breakdown, a friendship breakdown, whatever it is that's happened, bad sleep that day. And if we don't take that into account these days, we're probably not doing the best job we can as coaches. And that's something that I've had to balance a lot better across the last few years. And I think we've all taken on board in terms of if you want to be a great coach and if you want to continue to build really good relationships with the teams you have, that's a really important thing just to have on board with you. The second thing that I wanted to just quickly touch on is on the tour I just went on, I was away in the States for a few weeks, and that was obviously a little bit of a different environment because I was able to coach that group almost on a daily basis.
Yep.
So 12, 14 days we were on the floor together, both games and trainings. But we also had a lot of time to be able to have one-on-one time with the players and give individual feedback. So I felt like we were able to build relationships really fast. But it was really due to the environment that we're in. Yep. So it depends on what the environment is, what tournament or season you're in, and how often you're seeing those players in terms of how quickly you can get that rapport that we would all love to have with our players.
Yep. And it's amazing how often you sort of think back on it now and you think of if you go and play a tournament, which goes over, say, 2 to 3 days, it's amazing how much growth you get between game one and your last game compared to a season. And there are plenty of times where a tournament is worth maybe 6 weeks of a season because you're around each other all the time. You have to make adjustments and decisions on the fly and go through things. Like it happens inherently, I think, because of the amount of connection you have in that short amount of time.
The barbecues at the tournament. I know I joke about it.
You brought this up on an episode that Zoe's not here.
I know, decision. Right? But it does. It helps it does. Build the relationship, and it does if the coach rocks up, even if it's 20 minutes, hey, just came in to say hi, I'm heading over to the stadium. Just shows them that you're a little bit human as well. You're not just taking the coach's side. They need to see that side as well.
Yep.
And yeah, I think it's important as well. I think it's part of it.
Yep, absolutely. Next one is Ruud van Nistelrooy. And this is a little bit parent related that he's talking about on this one.
My son plays at Feyenoord. He played against Ajax under 14. He was on the bench. He didn't play. So in the car on the way back, he was like a bit moody, disappointed, complaining. Others about the coach, etc. And then I said, yeah, but Shaquille, you sound like a loser, you know? If you talk like this in a way, you sound like you lost. I said, you are blaming him, you're blaming her, you're blaming this, you're blaming everything. I said, but I don't hear one single thing about yourself. I said, winners, they take control and they blame themselves and they look where they can improve. Ask yourself the question, are you a loser or are you a winner? I said, for me, it doesn't matter. I don't mind. If you want to be a loser, be a loser. I still love you as much. But if you want to be a winner, take control of your life and stop complaining about others.
European take on parenting that has resonated very well with Nick in the corner over there. Maybe a little confronting on the whole, you're a loser, you're a winner. I don't think he's necessarily meaning on the pitch and scoreboard related as much as, you know, do you take responsibility and accountability for the position you're in at the moment. And look, we all get it. There are some things that are outside of our control as coaches, as players, as parents, everything in between. Completely get it. But there is also an element in there as well where at some point we've got to stop pointing the finger and start saying, no, 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 this is my responsibility to go and fix this. And it's hard to get players to that point. And I think you've both done a really good job of talking about building that connection with players during this pod today. And in particular, with the lens of the better relationship you have with them, the more honest you can be with them. And obviously, that's a situation where Van Nistelrooy was an excellent, you know, international footballer and all those sorts of things. And I would suggest his son's probably going to be okay in that world. But it is interesting the whole, at what point do we stop the finger pointing and do we start the fingers pointing back at us in that sort of world? Like, how do you view that, I suppose, Nick, with how you go about developing athletes?
Well, first of all, I'll take a step further than that. And like, that's something that I do even think about now in the future for Orlando. How am I going to navigate that for him? Because it's such a crucial point the first time it happens, because I know my brother's spoken to me in the past about his kids, and it's a difficult space to navigate. They're experiencing that for the first time. Like, how he puts it is like, you need to have that relationship with the player or your child very early on, like a strong connection to be able to have something so honest with them as well. They're not playing at all.
Yeah, it's maybe a little rough.
It's rough. Yeah. That's hard. Like, it's – I mean, it probably has happened. I have done it probably twice, maybe three times in my coaching. Okay, obviously, like, different levels. Like, yep. It's juniors. Everyone's usually going to play, so it's a little bit different. But to not play at all is a very difficult conversation. So if you're going to do it, like – my question is also at that, if they're 14s or under 16s, why are they on your team if they're not playing a single minute? They can't get on the court at all, ever. Like, I just find that really hard to believe. Anyway, make it easier for the parents. Just put them on the court a little bit so you have some data for them. That's my advice. Put them on for 3 minutes. Doesn't matter.
Yep. What about you, Dave?
I can actually remember each time that I've done it in terms of not playing a player and... Yep. Yeah, it's a little bit scarring. Like, it's something I would never do again at the junior level, obviously, we're talking. Yep. I understand how would you put it? Like, it's really, like, exhausting, mentally taxing. It can break down a player at that age. And
the team
a little bit as well. You know, it's a difficult position to be in for the parents. I think it just puts everyone in on edge, to be honest. So, yeah, if you're in junior sport, get people on the floor, get people on the court, get them on the field. Even if it's only for a short amount of time, it makes your job easier because you can still provide feedback. You can have whatever follow-up sessions you need to after that, but get them on the floor.
Yep. Yeah, I think teaching them that there are better players and there are players that are still developing. And therefore, the better players sometimes play, depending on what the game's like. Like, educating the players on that so they're aware of it, it still sucks for them, right? It doesn't mean they're not going to be like, well, this sucks. I'm one of the people that's getting 2 minutes. But at least you're helping them process it.
Yep.
But not playing at all is a – you've got a difficult conversation at practice next week.
Well, you do. And to be honest, I'm tipping you're not getting a parent like that.
Yeah.
That is saying, look at yourself before you start looking at everyone else. Because my experience of late has been – of parent complaints I hear about, and again, these are just the ones I get more than anything else, I would say upwards of 80 to 85% are court time related, which is just not the opportunity to play. And that is so controllable on our end. That is simply you're putting the scoreboard before you're putting, you know, player development, and that's not ideal from our situation. So just being mindful of it. You've got a very calm and composed parent there compared to what you normally deal with, which is a fairly upset parent. And I understand it in that space. So you do have to be a little bit careful, I think, as a coach in that world. Next one is Simon Sinek on burnout.
All you need is one person in your life who says, you got this, I believe in you, and you will find courage and energy to do things that you would not have had before. But more importantly, that person needs to also say, and if everything goes wrong, I will be there for you, and I will be there with you, and I will be in the mud with you, and has the ability to say, something's wrong, I'm worried about you. And I think burnout happens when you're attempting to do all of the things you see other people do and not realize that they have deep, meaningful relationships that you can't see. And you think, falsely, that you have to do it alone. And that's when burnout happens. Because you don't, as an individual, have the energy. But in community and in relationship and in friendship, it's remarkable, including knowing when to just take a little break to recharge.
So burnout is a drastic problem that we face in basketball, and that's not just players, that's coaches as well. How have you navigated that, Dave, through your years of this and not getting burnt out?
As a coach?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was not getting burnt out, by the way.
Yeah, thanks, mate.
You did say that. I was just highlighting it.
Yeah, it's very difficult once again. Probably not navigated it as well as I should have. Like, we all know, like, the space we are in is very taxing, very demanding of us, and we can spend more time in the coaching world, preparation in the coaching world, you know, looking back on what we've done and really not giving ourselves the break or the time away from it just to be like, okay, there's other parts of life I need to focus on here.
Yep.
So it's something I try to improve on. It's something that, you know, can just take over at times though. So it's, I don't have the solution for it. I try to make exercise like a space where I know I get an hour and a half a day where that's just my time, whether I go for a walk or go to the gym or take my dogs out to the park for a run. Yep. Like, that's my time to think about everything except for basketball or everything except for coaching. And that helps me. I need to be more consistent at it. And with all of those things, like we all know, nutrition and diet, like, play a part.
Yeah.
And when we get better at those sort of things, like, everything starts to slowly take shape and fall into place. So those are the two things I usually focus on.
Yep.
Because I know I can't always control how many hours I'm on the floor.
Yeah,
of course. And those sorts of things. So I want to control my time away and my brain space to just not be thinking about basketball, fueling my body the right way so I can prepare myself for some of those longer days that we might have.
Well, and it's amazing how many times you have a full-time job, but your full-time job is not a 40-hour-a-week job. It ends up being a 55 to 60-hour-a-week job on some of the slower weeks, because that's what the sport ends up being. Like, you end up doing a lot of stuff that, if you are in like those BDM type roles where you are responsible for whole programs, like, you're almost on call to everyone all the time, because just because you're free during the day doesn't mean someone else is free during the day. They're only free at 7:30 at night, so that stretches out a little bit further. Even like, if you're like me and you know you have like a 7 o'clock phone call, and it may not be a good 7 o'clock phone call as well, like, you might be having to deal with some stuff, you're thinking about that 7 o'clock phone call from about 5 p.m. So all of a sudden, that's now a 3 hour long phone call that you've got going on in your head. Then you have to have the phone call, and then it's probably another hour and a half afterwards that has impacted on, you know, potentially a 5 hour window for what is potentially a 15 minute phone call. And just, it's that getting that time away from it that I think is the important part, where you can shut off a little bit to it. Like, what do you do, Nick?
Well, first of all, I think I've spoken about this before, but I speak on behalf of a lot of coaches out there that say yes to way too much and get to a point where, like, it affects them. You talk about nutrition. I think our eating habits and our exercising habits get poor when we just run out of time. And there's a lot of coaches that are doing crazy amount of hours and then going to their job. Like, crazy. Like, at the moment as well, what's gearing up with trials, like, they are going to be flat out. Obviously, Dave, you know a lot about it because you've had to get hundreds of coaches on the court. So you probably are more aware of what they're doing and things like that. But, like, for me, like, just being able to say no and not be afraid that you're going to miss out is the biggest advice that I could give to a coach. Like, it just doesn't happen. Like, I've you know, it's probably more so the last, what, year and a half or so, I've said no to things. You know, I still speak to the same coaches. I still get advice from the same coaches. I still get the same amount of information, if not more. So, being able to say no, I think, is really important as well. Not to say that you say no to everything and just give it all up, because that's what will happen if you say yes to everything.
Yep.
It'll just implode.
Yep, makes sense. Next one is on habits over discipline. This is from the Diary of a CEO podcast. I can't think who the actual person on was, but worth a listen all the same.
The big mistake most people make is they see somebody like you. You go to the gym very often. Somebody who doesn't live a very disciplined life would look at you and say, God, I want to be like Steven. He's got all this discipline, going to the gym. But they don't understand that you going to the gym isn't discipline. It's a habit. So you're not, like, forcing yourself to go do something. You're doing something that's a habit for you. The discipline only is necessary at the very beginning to get this habit started. And I think if more people knew that you're just exercising a little discipline at the very beginning, and then it's just, that's just what you do. It's like somebody who sees someone brushing their teeth every day. Like, wow, that's so much discipline. It's just what we do. It's a habit.
So, interesting, the back of literally what you've just spoken about. How did you get into the habit, or how will you get into the habit of getting your hour and a half a day?
Yeah. Part of it is just me saying to myself, I have to be a little bit selfish here. Yep. I need to find like 90 minutes or 60 minutes a day where it's like, that's my time. And if I get an email, I'm not responding to it. And if I get a phone call, I'm not picking that phone call up. And I'm not changing that part of my day at all. So being a little bit selfish to make sure the rest of my day goes well has been really important for me. To make sure the rest of my week goes well is really important.
Yep.
And just to take care of myself, because I have definitely been in at those points where I've burnt out. Like, we've all worked in really like demanding jobs, as we spoke about.
Yep.
Jobs that require a lot of hours. And then on top of that, like the both of you have done, I've been silly enough to volunteer for a rep team, a state team, and maybe a yep. big V team at the same time. So mm-hmm. yep. we're talking about three teams on top of potentially a regular 38 hour to 50 hour a week job. You know, there's not a lot of time in there for yourself. So I think Nick hit the nail on the head talking about you need to tell people no every now and then, and those opportunities won't go away. They might just be there a bit later. Thinking about what works best for you and your schedule, and just making sure that you prioritize yourself, because I think if you give 50% of yourself to every one of those programs, you're not going to do a good job in any one of them. And I think we've all found that at some point in time.
Yep. So, I really like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read something about with Jim, if you want to get started to, there was this one person, I can't remember what book it was. It might be 5 AM Club, I yep. want to say, where they rocked it. He said to go to the gym and just go for 1 minute.
Timing habits.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So keep go talking. For one. Yeah. Yeah, one minute. And he would go every day for 1 minute. And then after a while, he's like, well, I keep coming here. I may as well stay longer than the 1 minute. So he's built the discipline just by coming for 1 minute, and then built the habit of coming every day.
Well, and even before that, it was just put the shoes on.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't even you have to go. It was just like, get used to putting the shoes on. And that is, it's kind of what we do as coaches anyway. Our job is to get players into the habit of doing certain things so that when it comes to a crunch moment, they are disciplined enough to do the right thing at the right time. That's coaching. Like, that's honestly our job, is to try and find ways to get kids into the right habits to be the best player they can possibly be as well. So it's an interesting little space, I think, that one in particular. This one is on coaches having favorites.
I will tell players, and coach, I think you should tell players the same thing. Like, I do have favorites. Like, let's just get it. Like, oh, she's my favorite. I do have favorites. I have favorites. These two are two of my favorites. Yes. She's my favorite. And then I will say, and why is that? Because they don't make excuses, because they work hard, because they listen, because they're vulnerable, because they try. Whose fault is it that these two are my favorite and you two are not? Yours and theirs. You want to be one of them? Act like it. You don't get it. I have favorites. It's your job to become one. And it's my job to make it very clear to you what it takes to be my favorite. A coach wants nothing more than a team full of shooters, full of leaders and favorites. Nobody has that team. Your job is to become those three things.
Interesting take on it, like maybe a touch aggressive on how he was talking about his favorites, but by the same token, like, that's, coaches do have favorites, Nick. What are the traits, I suppose, that would make up some of your favorite players, Nick?
Consistency on practice, ability to communicate with me during the game, I think is an important one as well. Buy-in and really attempting to find understanding. Every coach has favorites, and it's sort of unique to the personality. I think what's important, though, is as a coach, is not to punish those that are very different from your personality. They may not suit your style and you may need to adjust. That's not an excuse to go, yeah, that guy is saying he's got favorites, I've got favorites, and everyone else is just out. Like, that's not how it works either. So,
yep.
Yeah.
True. What about you, DP?
On the same page as Nick with the first few, commitment, reliability and communication. Like, if a player is doing all those three things, like, you love him or her. I think the next thing is they are able to pour in 100% of their energy to whatever it is we're doing for that day. And that doesn't have anything to do with skill. It yep. just means that when they are with us and we're in a team meeting, they're giving us 100% attention. When we're on the floor, they're giving us 100% of their energy and their effort. And I think that's really important, because what they're doing is they're turning up and they're doing their job. I think the third thing that I would always talk about is athletes that make others better. That's something that I was spoken to a lot about as a player when I was coached. And I think it's something that we got to continue to speak about now, in terms of a lot of the best players that are on the floor are players who are making their teammates better. And we don't necessarily see that a lot of the time because a lot of those things are not things that are statted. I spoke about Nick being a good screener. He didn't get a stat every time he set a good screen for the players that he played with when they scored. He didn't get a stat every time he boxed out and someone else got a rebound and we scored as a team. But those people are really important to teams. And I actually agree with the clip. Like, we have favourites, and it's, for me, it's those types of athletes on the floor.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. We always want talent. Yeah. Like, talent's, you know, but there have been plenty of talented players that I've had over the years that I haven't really got along with and hasn't been a favourite. Like, talent does not equal favourite. Doing the right things at the right times, being a good teammate, those are the things that, you know, it's hard not to be happy with kids that are happy as well, or players that are happy, that are just a bit of a vibe to be around. They're the favourites, the ones that you can have that little bit of an interaction with that's, you know, a little bit humorous or whatever the case might be. They're the ones you kind of remember. You don't necessarily remember the kid that drops 30 every game if they're a bit of a jerk of a kid. Like, or you might remember it for the wrong reasons.
Would you tell them at the start of the season, this is what I think would be my most favourite player to coach, and then just list the...
A little bit of Hunger Games type stuff where they can all fight for your love.
Yeah, 100%. Like, yeah, that's what I mean. Like, will they just play to that? Like, is it really... I don't know. It's a tough one, isn't it? Like,
you're at least setting them up for success. Like, they know.
Yeah, true.
Like, it's, but I think it has to be done collaboratively with, mm-hmm. well, okay, if this is my favourite type of player, what's your favourite type of coach? And they'll tell you very quickly what they want it to look like and, what more to the point, what they don't want it to look like. So I think that's important too. But, yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with sort of saying, well, look, these are the things that I really value as a coach. You know, and, you know, boxing out might be one of them. And, you know, as you say, that's not appearing on many stat sheets. But, you know, we all remember the kid that we enjoyed playing with that did the little gritty things that we didn't do ourselves or that made our life easier as a player. And we remember having those kids. Like, it's, there's a reason we can't have 10, 30-point-per-game scorers on a team. Like, it just doesn't work.
It doesn't even work at the NBA level.
No, not at all.
Right? Like, look at the teams that are winning. Like,
yep. You know. Exactly. Like, and we were talking about it literally before we started recording. Go and watch Eurobasket.
Yeah.
Like, every team has an absolute superstar that they build that thing around, and it is like, you better play your role if you're one of those other four people on the court at the time, because, sorry, if you think Luka Doncic doesn't have the ball in his hands on every possession, you are kidding yourself. If you think the ball isn't playing through Giannis on every possession, kidding yourself. It's, can you complement what they have? Again, a very different level to what a lot of our coaches are dealing with. Like, it's a different space, but that's what we are dealing with in that world.
Just to rewind back to what you asked in terms of, would we tell the players that this is what we think a player should look like, or we'd like them to look like? I think some of that would align with maybe your non-negotiables for the team. It may not be the exact same list, but a lot of it would align with maybe these are the standards I want to set for what we should be trying to achieve as individuals that would make, you know, us a really successful team. So that's somewhere where I think we could touch on it.
Yep. Really like it. We're done. Got through your first pod,
Dave. Good job, Dave.
Congratulations.
Thanks for your help, guys.
No. Hey, easy one. No stress at all on that one. Coaches, thanks very much for listening. We will be back after a little bit of a break, actually. We've got school holidays coming back, but Coach Wellbeing Month is quite literally just a couple of weeks away before we start getting you all the information, and then November for the challenge. So we'll be back shortly with some more information on that. Good luck with your coaching, and we'll catch everyone next time we're on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.